KALW.
Sure, as you know, people are living on the edge right now in terms of their lives and their livelihood.
As the latest wave of coronavirus cases prompts more restrictions, U.S. lawmakers continue to negotiate a relief package.
We have to make sure the resources are there to purchase the quantity of vaccines that are needed.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee shares what she hopes to see from the Biden administration in 2021. Then an Oakland artist with Southern roots pays homage to his enslaved ancestors.
And part of my work is to go get my folks. I'm going to go get you and I'm going to liberate you and I'm going to free you forever.
And we'll hear stories of musicians behind bars.
I do my music because it's therapeutic. It's the only way I could really get suppressed emotions out.
A story from Uncuffed and more. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba and this is Cross Currents. Today's the day that United States electors cast their votes for the next president, making Biden's win in the November 3rd election official. And there's a lot this incoming administration will be tackling. A coronavirus vaccine that's just starting to be distributed, figuring out how to reopen our economy, and the list goes on. So what are our elected representatives looking at right now in this transition? Our colleagues at KALW's City Vision spoke with Congresswoman Barbara Lee about Biden's policies and what they might mean for the Bay Area. Here's host Ethan Elkind.
So we've got President-elect Biden coming into office next month. What do you see as the actions that he and the new Congress are going to be likely to take to address COVID in those first 100 days?
Well, I think he has laid it out, and I'm really pleased that he has put, quote, crushing this virus as a top priority. He has said he's going to ask for everyone to wear masks for 100 days. He's going to come up with a system, a distribution system for the vaccine. And we're going to have to come up with a major stimulus plan. Remember, ours was over $3 trillion, now whittled down to 900 and some billion. And so we're going to have to go back to the drawing board and come up with a real economic recovery plan that includes the health provisions as well as provisions for economic stability and recovery and job creation. Because remember, so many people lost their jobs, which will not return. And so we're going to have resources in for job training and retraining. And I'm confident that in the first 100 days, the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration will live up to what they have committed to living up to.
Well, and you mentioned the vaccine. So what would you like to see the Biden administration do to ensure that it's widely and equitably distributed?
Well, what first thing is we have to make sure the resources are there to purchase the quantity of vaccines that are needed for our vulnerable populations, essential workers, for all of the top priority populations that have been designated, but also moving forward so that we can have at least 70 to 80% of the population vaccinated. And then secondly, we have to help set up a distribution system, help the states do that. Right now, some states are moving forward because they have the resources. Others just don't have the money to set up a distribution system. So we're going to have to be partners with the state in terms of finding the actual resources and the methodology, the systems that need to be established for vaccinations, because evidently we're going to have a heck of a lot more than what has already been ordered by the Trump administration.
Well, and a lot of people have expressed skepticism about taking the vaccine. What do you say to people who might be reluctant to be a quote, guinea pig on the vaccine?
Well, I say I see you and I hear you, especially if you're an African-American or a person of color, because we are very skeptical because of, in many, many issues, the Tuskegee study where we were used as guinea pigs and, you know, experimental treatments. We haven't been included in a lot of the clinical trials. Medically underserved communities, even where there are healthcare systems in place, access has been denied and people of color have been mistreated. I remember stories just recently of African Americans showing up at the emergency room with COVID, and they were sent home and they died. They weren't even treated in a way that everyone should be treated when you go to an emergency room. So there's enough skepticism in our healthcare system because of historical systemic racism that I understand that. But having said that, we're going to have trusted messengers. And I'm glad the former presidents are going to be vaccinated in public. We're going to have people who our communities believe in and trust be the public health messengers. I have a bill, the COVID Community Care Act, which would provide resources for nonprofits, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations to provide the testing, contact tracing, treatment, and referrals for isolation. But it also would provide resources to train trusted messengers in the community to deliver the public health messages, because we have to have people who are multilingual, who can speak the language, who understands the culture and the skepticism, who can deliver these public health messages. Otherwise, people will not believe their government once again. And we have to understand there are plenty of reasons that people do not believe that the government is going to be on their side once again.
My last question for you is just, you know, of all of the issues we've covered in this discussion just now, you know, what else would you see as possibly happening in those first 100 days? You know, that's typically when you see the most, you know, congressional action with a new president coming in. And I'm just wondering what you would see as sort of the issues that people should be expecting some action on.
Well, I tell you that right now, looking at where we are, it's going to be the coronavirus, attacking the coronavirus. That's going to take up a heck of a lot. Of course, we've got to put forth a climate bill, which is going to be extremely important. But I think right now, when the Biden-Harris administration takes over, making sure we have an economic recovery plan, a stimulus plan that's going to put people back to work, and that's going to make sure that our businesses, and especially our small and minority businesses, are able to come back into business if they were shut down, and move forward and employ people and create jobs like they do in such a way that we couldn't survive without our small businesses. So I think that's it. The health agenda and the economic agenda in the first 100 days is going to be a very aggressive agenda, and we've got to look at it in terms of saving lives and livelihoods, and that's the first 100 days.
That was Congresswoman Barbara Lee speaking with KALW's City Visions host, Ethan Alkind. You can find a longer version of that conversation at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Oakland artist Brian Keith Thomas grew up in a small Tennessee town that had a big impact on his work. His paintings honor Black Southern culture, Black spirituality, and ancestry. Thomas's art has been featured not only around the country, but internationally. Former First Lady Laura Bush gave him the White House honor for his art in U.S. embassies. Now his work is on display in the DeYoung Museum's open exhibit. KALW's Janae Darden had a deep conversation with Brian Keith Thomas. He starts by talking about race in his hometown, Dyersburg.
Dyersburg is a small town about 2 hours north of Memphis. And one thing very special about the town is the town holds a lot of energy about that represents transition and represents aspects about race and race relations. When my grandparents moved there, I think in the 20s, and they owned a store for about 45 years. And then when urban renewal came in the 70s, their children split the money. Some went to college, some purchased a home. My parents bought a house in a working class community surrounded by a lot of white people. So what happened is when I grew up, a lot of the people that cared for me were old white women. A lot of these old white women also were collectors. And our conversations would be, you know, even as a five-year-old, why do you have black dogs in your house? So they would look at me like, so we'd have these conversations about ownership. And then they would talk about their collections and they would show me their antique furniture and we'd have all these amazing connections. And as I grew up, I mowed every yard in my community, outside of my community. So I worked for all these older white women, but we would always have conversations about objects and about heirloom, you know, and they would teach me about how to close a drawer. This is a Lillian Russell bedroom suite, all those things about craftsmanship and heirloom. At the same time in that small town, I would go to my grandmother's place in the country where the old folks would say, if the Lord allowed me to see tomorrow, I'm going to plant the garden over there. So then we'd work in the dirt and we change seeds and we do landscaping. So all of a sudden, as a child, I realized that there is a holy moment in how time travels, how an object travels through time. A seed travels through time, comes, greet you, and then it goes back to its source. And an object is with you for a certain amount of time, like a beautiful piece of furniture, and it transitions and goes to someone else. So, but they all have a story.
I noticed that many of the subjects of your painting, they have like this halo or aura around them. And your pieces, they're featured in churches and spiritual communities around the world. And what you do with the church fans are just beautiful. But talk about spirituality in your work.
Well, you know, I was looking for something that symbolized this community. And I was looking for something that I knew that was familiar to me. And growing up in the church, I remember seeing the church fans. And I was in graduate school and I decided, and that's my subject, you know, the church fans. It was a sacred object that we passed out, you know, during a service. And folks would get the Holy Ghost with this thing. And they shout with this thing. And they sing and they moan. And then we take them back up and we put them in a cabinet. It's a sacred object. So I said, what better to be a platform of a holy moment than a church fan? And then within those church fans, I use, you know, photographs, drawings, things that talk about aspects of transition and ecstasy, you know. So what I mean by that is in those times of transition, sometimes the images have this kind of white smoke or this kind of white fog. I call that the Holy Ghost, because what happens is there's a change of time. You can't quite see exactly what's going on, and there's something moving. And wind is one of those things that it's in your presence, but you know it because of something else moving. Mm-hmm. So the white fog I call the Holy Ghost, and oftentimes you'll see a silhouette or dark areas, and that dark area is just like one more portal coming to love you, because sometimes the symbol of a human being is more powerful than just a symbol where you see every feature. So I paint the features in and then I smoke them out and I kind of paint them out, because in some of your most sacred times of transition, it was in the dark. You know, you think about African-American people going to freedom, you know, it was during the night. You know, all those dark silhouettes are like our ancestral portals coming to love us.
Ooh, I have to pause and digest that. I noticed textures and pieces that you use that for some people is triggering in our Black history, like mammy cookie jars and cotton. Why do you use items that some people may say is kind of taboo?
Part of my work is to introduce us to our folks. And part of my work is to go get my folks. I'm going to go get you and I'm going to liberate you and I'm going to free you forever. So you may have been born into this world as a McCoy cookie jar, but when you come home, I'm going to give you a halo and I'm going to sanctify you as a forever free person. And when I say forever free, sometimes there's rituals with my paintings where actually I give them freedom papers. But this point on, you are known as free. And I've had ceremonies where Black women have named other Black women that have gone down in history as Black woman or slave, nurse, and child. Who are you calling a slave, nurse, and child? Can you imagine forever going down in history with one picture of you and someone calls you a slave, nurse, and child? You are many things. So I take that picture, I paint it, and I change it the way myself and the picture feels like it should be changed. And then I liberate her. I free her.
Freedom. You've painted incredible images of Harriet Tubman. What does Harriet Tubman mean to you?
but she's a powerful icon that is not just an icon, but she's also a human being. And when you read her narratives, people talk about not only just her being a soldier, also her being a lover. There's men that talk about how beautiful she was in her African features. So whenever I paint her, I want to channel aspects of her humanness, not just her superhero-ness. It's because she was a mother. She took care of this young woman. So she's a mother. She also had, you know, a couple of husbands. All those aspects talk about her being this above more than one thing. Oftentimes we give people this superhero status and we forget. At times she may have to weep and moan as well. There's times where she has to be held as well. So within my images, when I paint her, I want her to look noble and strong because she is, but I also often not times may put a ring on her finger to let you know that she's also committed to a dream that's above serving you. It's serving herself as well.
And I can relate to that as a Black woman. What do you want your work to convey to people about Black Southern culture?
That it exists. And it has been here for a long time, and they created its heirloom pieces, and they're going to be here long after the physicality of you looking at them is gone. So for my paintings, I want you to be able to have a quiet moment and just reflect, because regardless of what your background is, we all respond to the love language of sincerity. And in the paintings, that's what I'm talking about. I am Black, and I love being Black, but I also, even deeper, I'm human.
That was artist Brian Keith Thomas speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. You can see his work as part of the DeYoung Museum's open exhibit until January 3rd. Of course, the DeYoung is closed because of COVID, but you can see the art virtually. We've got a link at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next is a story from the producers of Uncuffed at San Quentin Radio.
From Solano State Prison,
this is Uncuffed.
Eric Abercrombie is also known as Maserati E. He's 25 years old, and he's been in prison for the last 8 years. He's a guitarist, a singer, and a songwriter. He visited San Quentin Radio to share his story.
No lie, yeah, yeah. Please feel me. Maserati E.
My name is Eric Abercrombie, aka Maserati E. I've been doing music forever and a day. I picked up the guitar in 2012 in Old Folsom, and music is my passion. That's my life. That's my everything. For me, I do my music mainly because it's therapeutic. It's the only way I could really get suppressed emotions and thoughts and stuff like that out. I can't really express myself through speaking like how I can through the music. I don't necessarily have to say a word, but once I play the guitar, play the piano, anything like that, it's like I'm letting it all out. I could allow my emotions to be heard and be felt. It's like so visceral.
I've been up all night, too much anticipation. I've been waiting my whole life, but I'm tired of waiting. So it's
like when my brother got killed, the music definitely got me through it. I wrote quite a few songs about it. It's in like a lot of my lyrics, you know what I mean?
It's the eyes, man. No lie, I just gotta stay alive, man. Cause tomorrow ain't promised to nobody, can't nobody.
It definitely helped me get through my morning, I guess you could say. And it really helped me with accepting it. Cause for like quite some time, it didn't even seem real. It was like, man, this shit is crazy. But then, you know, like, through the music, I was able to really, like, able to really vent and not just suppress it, because I wasn't talking to nobody about it. Like, I was also, like, fake-ass bravado type, you know what I mean? Like, I'm good, ain't nothing wrong. Like, I'm just chilling, this, that, and the other. But inside, I was sick.
Trying to find me a better way to stack this money to the sky, make it elevate. Planning like a mastermind each and every day.
And it was, like, hella songs that I was making. I wasn't showing nobody because I was exposing that pain, exposing that sickness. But then eventually it got to the point where it was like, I felt like people got to hear this, because I know I wasn't the only one going through that. You know what I mean? Like, the people that I was around, you feel me? I'm from Oakland, and, like, people get killed all the time. Like, got hella dead partners for real. So it was like, when it's so frequent, you know what I mean? When it's so frequent and it happens on a frequent basis like that, I mean, eventually you're going to get used to it. You're going to become desensitized to death and things like that. Even though it still hurt, but it start not to hurt as bad as it used to.
Stack this money to the sky, make it elevate. Planning
music, like I said, is my form of therapy. So it's like me and my bros, you feel me? It was like we going through the same stuff. So I started kind of feeling kind of selfish a little bit.
I'm so tired of struggling, I really am.
Knowing that to a certain degree, it was making me feel better. So based on that, I know that it was relatable to a lot of other people. I started kind of exposing that, and it was being felt. And then they was able to feel a sense of release through me.
Broke now, trying to build up, trying to stack to the ceiling. Hungry like the children in the African village. I know it's gonna get greater later, man. Trying to speak it to existence, why I say them things. I learned you gotta go through hell to get to heaven.
That was Maserati E. He's currently incarcerated at San Quentin State Prison, and he's set to be released in August. Ton Tran produced that piece. He's a student in KALW's radio program at San Quentin State Prison. Uncuffed is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. Listen to more stories at kalw.org/uncuffed.
Use this time to try to find me a better way to stack this money to the sky, make it elevate. Planning like a mastermind each and every day, day, no lie, yeah.
And now it's time for New Arrivals, our mini reading series with local Bay Area authors.
This is New Arrivals, a socially distanced book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Andrea Lowe is a photographer from Berkeley, and Valerie Liu is a writer living in San Francisco. They co-authored a book called Chinatown Pretty, which came out in September.
Chinatown Pretty is a photo and storytelling project that celebrates the street style and wisdom of senior citizens we've met in Chinatowns across North America. It describes this style that is, to us, a fascinating patchwork of patterns and colors, eras, layers, and handmade details.
And here's a story about a pawpaw, or grandma, that we met in San Francisco Chinatown. A Chinatown Pretty outfit is like a short story. There's a narrative, there are themes and references. And once you read through the whole outfit, you'll be delighted, amused, or inspired, maybe even all at once. That's what happened when we met this woman while we're installing our first gallery show at 41 Ross, an art and community space in Chinatown. We like how certain elements show up several times in our outfit. Jade jewelry, knitwear, fleece, and multiple pops of pink, like her socks. Another time we ran into her at Ross Alley wearing a powerful outdoor pajama set with bold pink florals and mustard yellow buttons. This time, another surprise. She was sporting a pink froggy pinky ring. Minds blown and hearts exploded again. The story of a Chinatown Pretty outfit sometimes leads to a punchline. In this case, the kicker was a pair of pink socks that read, "My favorite salad is wine."
That was Andrea Lowe and Valerie Liu reading from Chinatown Pretty.
New Arrivals is produced by KALW's Lisa Morehouse. Find out how to subscribe to the podcast at kalw.org/newarrivals. Today's Cross Currents team includes Scott Carroll, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Lisa Ramreka. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.